Harper Audio presents Cash Landing by James Grappando, performed by Jonathan Davis. November, 2009. Chapter 1. Getting rich in Miami was easy, or so Reuben Betancourt was told. Miami had Boomtown written all over it, again. The Great Recession was over. The perils of reckless borrowing and NINA loans, no income, no assets, no problem, were yesterday's news. Cash was king. A new Bentley Continental GT like Paris Hilton's? Cash. Hitting Miami Beach to clean out Chanel at Bal Harbour shops? More cash. A penthouse in Sunny Isles? All cash. No mortgage required. Brazilians, Argentinians, Mexicans, anyone with a Latin fortune was flush with cash and buying up Miami. Reuben saw the expensive cars and jewelry all around him, but he wasn't plugged into the new economy, and he didn't understand it. One year the banks loved him, couldn't give him enough credit, and talked him and his wife into a house and NINA loan that they couldn't possibly afford. All you need is a pulse and credit score, their mortgage broker had assured them. As it turned out, that pulse thing was optional. Fraudulent loans to dead people were soaring, right along with bank profits. 2 years into their subprime mortgage, the Betancourts were in foreclosure and out on the street. Their dream house was scooped up for a song on the courthouse steps by investors who paid, what else? Cash. Front end and back end, the banks won. But not this time. Reuben got smart and looked to the skies. Not at the new high-rise condos and office towers that had reshaped Miami's skyline. His eye was on money flights. Commercial jets pregnant with bags of U.S. currency in their cargo bellies. "Touchdown!" shouted Reuben. He was in the passenger seat of a borrowed pickup truck, listening to the Miami Dolphins football game on the radio. The color commentator added his patented, "All right, Miami," over the airwaves. Reuben slapped a high five with his brother-in-law, Jeffrey Beauchamp, who was behind the wheel. The truck was parked alongside Perimeter Road near Miami International Airport. Jeffrey's uncle, Craig Pinky Perez, was in the back seat. A fully loaded Makarov 9mm semi-automatic pistol tucked under his belt.
"They're still gonna lose," said Pinky.
The pessimism was warranted. The team was rebuilding, and just 8 weeks into the new season, they already had 5 losses.
"Maybe I should buy the team," said Jeffrey.
"Maybe you should shut up," said Pinky.
"Maybe you should..."
"Everybody shut it," said Reuben. "Just shut up and watch the fucking planes."
The family dynamics were wearing thin on Reuben. He'd approached a couple of buddies to pull off the heist with him. 2 pros with balls as big as globes, but who had passed because it sounded too risky. He was stuck with family. Pinky would probably be okay, with an impressive criminal record to prove it. Jeffrey, on the other hand, was 5'6" tall and weighed 300 pounds, and the number one woman in his life was still his mother. Always smiling, he loved to laugh, even at himself. But he was as gullible as a 10-year-old. It was like asking the actual loser on The Biggest Loser to knock off a bank, with the added dimension of drug addiction, which meant that he spent half his life coked up and binging, the other half sleeping it off. Jeffrey would be the driver, just the driver.
"Hey, is that it?"
asked Jeffrey as he peered out the windshield. Their truck was south of the airport on the other side of a 12-foot fence of chain link topped with barbed wire. They had a clear view of the runway and control tower.
"Looks like a jumbo jet to me," said Pinky.
The plane descended from the west, flying over the uninhabited Florida Everglades. Reuben had counted almost 4 dozen landings since 1 p.m., a typical afternoon at MIA, the second busiest airport in the country for international traffic. But Reuben was getting antsy. The scheduled arrival time for Lufthansa flight 462 from Frankfurt was 1:50 p.m. It was now 2 o'clock. He smiled as he spotted the telltale bump on the forward double-deck section of the fuselage of the Boeing 747.
"That's it, bro."
"Yeah, baby!"
The landing gear deployed, the nose lifted, and the plane touched down at the west end of the runway. The engines whined as the plane rolled past them. The airline's logo, a circle of gold on the deep blue tail, seemed to smile on them like the Florida sun.
"Payday," said Reuben.
"All right, Miami," said Jeffrey. "Touchdown!"
The idea of a heist had been planted in Reuben's brain over the summer. He was nearly floored by what his old friend was telling him. "Money flights happen every day, bro. $80 million, $100 million every fucking day." The Miami branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta is just northwest of the Miami International Airport, a distance of about 4 miles as the crow flies, a 15-minute ride by armored truck. When a foreign bank has more U.S. currency on hand than needed, it physically ships the bills to the United States for deposit at one of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks. South Florida's cash-hungry Latin community made Miami a prime destination. Reuben had been planning and preparing for months. He'd studied enough maps of the area to know that the Lufthansa flight flew right past the Miami Fed upon approach to the south runway. The shipment's ultimate destination, however, was as irrelevant as the world economic events that impacted the value of the U.S. dollar and fueled these money flights. To Reuben and his partners in crime, the 747 was nothing more than bags of cash, low-hanging fruit, theirs for the taking. Reuben's phone rang and he answered immediately. It was his source, the old friend who had tipped him off about the money flights. This was the call he had been waiting for. Time to move.
"Understood," he said into his cell. 10 minutes. He hung up.
Clearing customs was normally a 2-hour process, but the armored car guards were moving faster than usual. The Lufthansa container had been transported from the aircraft to the warehouse. All bags had been inspected for tampering and tearing, the cash accounted for, and the bags resealed. The process of loading the armored truck was soon to begin. In another half hour, the money would be heading north on the Palmetto Expressway at 55 miles per hour, unless Reuben made his move.
"Drive," Reuben told his brother-in-law.
"How much are we talking about?"
40-some bags. $2 million per bag, give or take, depending on the mix of bills. The math was beyond Jeffrey.
"Sweet," he said,
as he steered onto the perimeter road. It was a short drive to the airport warehouse on Northwest 18th Street. Reuben and Pinky put on latex gloves to make sure there would be no fingerprints when they pulled themselves up on the loading dock. Jeffrey parked outside the open cargo door. He kept the motor running. The time was 3:08 p.m. Reuben could hardly believe that the enormous bay door was wide open, though he knew it would be. It was one of the many lapses in security that would make this job so easy. Each of those vulnerabilities had been spelled out to him in advance. Bricks of bills lay exposed on the concrete floor. Federal law prohibited any private citizen, including armored truck guards, from carrying a weapon into the customs clearance site. So the guards were required to remove all weapons before entering the warehouse and performing any clearance tasks. The CCTV cameras were monitored by the security staff at the main terminal, well away from the warehouse, and the crooks would be long gone before the weakened security guard noticed anything awry on one of his many screens and contacted police. The kicker in this incredible equation was that the gaping bay doors led directly to a public access road running parallel to the building. A fast-moving getaway vehicle could bypass the airport perimeter fence and the gatehouse and be on the expressway in less than 60 seconds. Reuben had gotten all this information from a trusted old friend, a childhood buddy he'd grown up with in Cuba. Reuben's given name was Carl, which is not a Hispanic name, but decades of Soviet influence in Cuba had many faces, including that of Reuben's father, a Russian soldier who never married Reuben's mother and who was shipped off to Afghanistan, where he was killed when Reuben was 3. Carl and his older sister were half-Cubans. Reubens, who lived on a single mother's salary of $20 per month, paid in moneda nacional and supplemented by rice and beans rations and other necessities provided by the Cuban government. They owned no car. Their television worked intermittently, but in any case, they watched only what the government allowed them to watch. The Castro regime's ban on international travel by Cuban citizens meant that no one in the Betancourt family had left the island since 1959. Reuben was among the next generation of refugees, part of President Clinton's Cuban crisis, having left only when he decided to leave for good at the age of 17. If ever he returned, it would be as a rich man. He would stay at the Hotel Nacional along with the European tourists. He'd drink mojitos all day and lounge on the white sand beaches at Veradero. But first, there was work to do. His real job as a restaurant manager kept him too busy to indulge in hobbies, yet Reuben did have one, his gun collection. Mostly Russian-made pistols. They would come in handy in this new job.
"Ready, Reuben?" asked Pinky.
The Reuben nickname had stuck. Not even his wife called him Carl.
"Let's do this," said Reuben.
Reuben and Pinky put on sunglasses to hide their eyes and pulled ski masks over their heads. They got out of the truck and hauled themselves up onto the loading dock. Pinky pulled the Makarov 9mm semi-automatic pistol as they ran into the warehouse. Reuben gave the order, first in English and then in Spanish.
"Down on the floor! Everybody down!"
The scene was exactly as Reuben had been told it would be. A cavernous warehouse littered with crates and plastic packing wrap. Canvas bags lay right by the doors, protected by only a handful of unarmed guards and warehouse workers. They complied immediately and dropped to the floor. The thieves moved quickly. Reuben grabbed 4 bags, 2 in each hand, nearly his own body weight in $1,500 bills. Pinky brandished the Makarov, never letting his guard down, but grabbed 2 more bags with his free hand.
"Like bags of cement," Reuben said, groaning.
Easy money didn't mean easy to carry. 1 bag was dropped in their race back to the truck.
"Shit! Leave it! Go, go, go!"
They left it on the floor, threw the 5 bags into the bed of the truck as they hopped down from the loading dock and jumped into the cab.
"Vaya!"
Jeffrey hit the gas. The truck sped away. The men pulled off their ski masks, slapped high fives, and showered themselves with hoots and hollers of congratulations. Jeffrey felt the excitement, maybe too much.
"Hey, Reuben!"
He was driving so fast that the steering wheel was vibrating in his hands.
"Tell me where we're going again?"
Reuben slugged him in the arm. They'd gone over the escape countless times.
"Shit, Jeffrey! Turn here!"
A hard right and the tire squealed as they ran the stop sign. They were deep into the warehouse district.
"Left!" shouted Reuben.
Jeffrey steered toward the Miami Tile and Marble Depot. It was closed on Sundays, but the garage door opened as they approached. The black pickup entered and continued through the warehouse without stopping, passing pallets of tile and marbles stacked floor to ceiling on either side. As the garage door closed behind them, a cargo door opened before them. It was the rear loading platform, where a delivery truck was backed up against the elevated dock. Its roll-up door was wide open. Jeffrey drove the pickup straight into the empty box of the delivery truck, stopped,
then switched on the running light so they could see. Reuben and Pinky jumped out of the pickup, secured the axles to the bed of the delivery truck with chains, and chocked the wheels with wooden blocks.
"Done!" shouted Reuben.
Pinky pulled down the roll-up door. Reuben banged on the metal wall between him and the cab. The driver was Marco, a forklift operator who was the lone security guard on Sundays, a friend of Pinky's.
"Go!"
They jumped into the bed of the pickup. Canvas bags of money lay between them as the delivery truck pulled away from the loading dock.
"Ha ha! Home free!" said Pinky. "So easy!"
Reuben leaned back against one of the bags, a lumpy mattress of money.
"Too easy. That's what worries me."
Chapter 2. The search for a black pickup truck with an extended cab was in high gear. It was led by the FBI but involved an alphabet soup of state and local agencies, from the FHP, Florida Highway Patrol, and FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, to the MDPD, Miami-Dade County Police Department, and its airport substation. Countless squad cars were on alert in the Tri-County area, north to Palm Beach and south to the Florida Keys. FBI and MDPD helicopters were airborne, crisscrossing the skies. The black pickup was their holy grail, but they were also searching for discarded money bags, weapons, latex gloves, or ski masks along the road. Mindful that profiling was a legal no-no, law enforcement had an eye out for any vehicle with three men inside, possibly Hispanic, especially if it was fast-moving and seemingly in getaway mode. The access road by which the thieves had fled was completely shut down, and the entire warehouse and surrounding area was a secured crime scene. Special Agent Andy Henning was the first FBI agent to reach the warehouse. Andy was entering her fifth year with the Bureau, all but the last 6 weeks of which had been in the Seattle field office, where she'd spent 18 months in the bank robbery unit. She'd made a name for herself in a lengthy undercover assignment in the Yakima Valley, and she was promised more of that work if she transferred to Miami. So far, the promise had been unfulfilled. She was assigned to Tomcat, a multi-jurisdictional task force that focused on the growing number of organized crime syndicates involved in cargo heists. On the upside, the transfer did at least put 2,000 miles between Andy and her ex-fiancé. But that was another story.
"I see the Bureau sends the newbie on Sunday afternoons," said MDPD Lieutenant Elgin Watts. He was one of the co-founders of Tomcat.
Andy wasn't exactly a newbie, but she knew what he meant.
"Littleford is on his way."
Supervisory Special Agent Michael Littleford was the head of the FBI's bank robbery unit, a 25-year veteran. A dozen officers from MDPD were already on the scene, most of them with Tomcat. It wasn't Andy's place to tell them, at least not yet, but Tomcat would be playing a supporting role in this case. The typical cargo heist involved truckloads of everything from designer clothes to pharmaceuticals, and law enforcement's key to success was finding the warehouses the syndicates used to store the stolen goods. Here, the stolen currency had been on its way to the Federal Reserve Bank, and the warehouse was just the starting point. The FBI would assert its bank robbery jurisdiction as soon as Littleford arrived.
"How much did they get?" asked Andy.
They were standing in front of the 36 bags of cash that the thieves had left untouched. The empty armored truck hadn't moved, its doors wide open.
"Not sure yet," said Watts. "But if you're a trivia nut, I'd say at least a few million more than the JFK Lufthansa heist. We may be looking at a new record."
Anyone in law enforcement who'd worked a bank robbery or armored truck heist knew about JFK. But this wasn't the time to debate the dollar value in 1978 versus the 21st century.
"Who was first on the scene?"
"Officer Foreman,
He works out of the MDPD airport substation.
How many witnesses? Asked Andy.
4 guards and 4 warehouse employees. They're sitting over there with Foreman, he said, indicating with a jerk of his head. Andy wondered which one would be trading in his uniform for prison garb.
A job like this doesn't happen without inside help.
Yep,
said Watts.
What about camera surveillance?
2 outside cameras, 4 inside. They're all monitored by airport security from the main terminal. Crooks were out of here before security noticed anything and dispatched police.
You think the guy watching the screens was in on it? Maybe looking the other way?
Honestly, I don't. I talked with the director of airport security. The weekend staff is shorthanded. Just 3 guys watching dozens of screens that cover the entire airport.
Wouldn't they be more focused on this particular warehouse when $100 million in cash is clearing customs?
The policy is not to give advance notice of a cash delivery to the guards who watch the CCTV screens or to anyone else who isn't part of a very small need-to-know circle. It makes sense. The more $15-an-hour employees who know exactly when $100 million will be spread across the floor in the warehouse, the more people you tempt into planning an inside job.
Andy couldn't disagree with his logic, but she still suspected an insider. Her gaze drifted back to the 8 men who were in the warehouse at the time of the heist, the armored truck guards in particular. Which one you got your eye on? Asked Andy.
One of the guards. Octavio Alvarez, Cuban-American guy.
Watts was showing his bias from Tomcat experience, where the Cuban connection was always part of any investigation into a cargo heist. Cuban-American crime syndicates in Miami preyed on Cuban nationals in Havana and other cities. The price of a trip to Florida was an indefinite stint as a lumper offloading truckloads of stolen cargo, followed by a string of heists around the country. For some young men, the risk of incarceration in the United States outweighed the risk of a leaky boat across the shark-infested Florida Straits.
Why Alvarez? Asked Andy.
He shrugged. Just a hunch.
It was possible that his hunch was correct, but Andy was trying to clear her head of the stereotypes that might apply in a Tomcat case. Cargo theft at the FBI was part of major thefts, grouped together with stolen jewelry, art, vehicles, and the like. Bank robbery was part of violent crimes, grouped together with gangs, kidnapping, murder for hire, and serial killings. It wasn't about turf wars. It involved different training, made investigators think differently, and changed the way they looked at things. As far as criminal enterprises went, cargo heists were comparatively low risk, while thieves who targeted money flights had historically shown an uncanny knack for ending up dead or in prison. The hunches an investigator followed early on were critical, which in Andy's mind underscored the need for the FBI to take control of the crime scene.
Where the heck are you, Little Furt? I want to talk to all of the guards, said Andy.
Better move fast. Braxton Security will have its lawyers here any minute. That's rarely a good thing for the flow of information.
Andy checked her watch. Littleford was hands-on, and she knew he would want to be part of the witness interrogations. She'd give him 2 more minutes, tops.
Tell me more about the CCTV cameras. What'd we get?
Not much more than the eyewitnesses gave us. Outside cameras confirmed the getaway vehicle was a black Ford F-150. Also picked up a plate number, but it turned out to be stolen from some old lady's Cadillac in Doral, so that leads us nowhere. Inside cameras show both perps, but at the end of the day, we're left with 2 males of average height and build wearing ski masks and sunglasses.
I'll get my tech people to see about enhancing it.
Andy sent a quick message to her tech agent, then walked toward the cargo lift. Watt showed her where the black pickup had parked and pointed out the bag that never made it to the truck. It was still on the floor where the thieves had dropped it.
expensive case of the dropsies. Check for prints, said Andy.
I'm sure we'll get some, but not any from the perps. Witnesses say they wore gloves.
An FBI van pulled up outside the open cargo doors. Several agents jumped out and entered the warehouse. Another van was right behind. Special Agent Littleford hopped up on the loading dock and entered the warehouse.
Fill me in, he said to Watts. And FBI takes jurisdiction from here.
The direct approach.
Andy listened as Watts gave Littleford the same quick recap, and then Littleford followed up with some questions of his own.
No shots fired, you confirm that? He asked.
Correct, none.
How well armed were the perps?
At least one handgun, for sure. Witnesses agree that it looked like a semi-automatic.
I've already told Tech to work on the security video, said Andy. Hopefully we'll get a make and model on the gun.
Which they've dumped by now, if they're smart, said Littleford.
Watts agreed.
Seems to me they came here knowing that none of the guards would be armed and wanted to have as many hands free as possible to carry out the money bags. But it would be safe to assume more firepower in the truck to ward off any pursuit. The Bolo says armed and dangerous, he added, referring to the Be on the Lookout alert.
Littleford started across the warehouse, taking Andy with him.
Let's talk to the witnesses, he said,
but then he stopped short at the bag of cash that the thieves had dropped.
This is our best friend right here, he said. Even if they wore gloves, and we don't lift a single print.
How so? Asked Andy.
We have no shots fired, no blood, and no one hurt.
Well, that's all about to change.
I don't have to be the fly on the wall to hear them arguing already. Dude, you're the one who dropped the bag. That comes out of your split.
Oh, yeah. It's gonna get ugly. Real ugly.
Andy returned the thin law enforcement smile. This wasn't the undercover work she'd transferred across the country to do, but she liked the way Littleford operated.
Come on, he said.
Let's go find their insider.
Chapter 3. 5 sealed canvas bags lay in a heap. A virtual mountain of concealed cash lying on the cracked and oil-stained garage floor. The transfer of the money bags from the getaway truck to the trunk of Ruben's car had gone off without a hitch. Marco from the Tile Depot had supplied the borrowed black pickup, and it was his job to ditch it. Jeffrey and his uncle left in separate cars and in opposite directions. Ruben drove off with the money, but only after assuring his co-conspirators that all 5 bags would remain sealed until it was time to make the split. They agreed it would be that night in the garage at the Betancourt's rental house.
Open it, bro, said Jeffrey.
Reuben was standing over the bags with a kitchen knife in his hand. Pinky was beside him. It was just the 3 of them. The others would get their money later.
Hold on, said Pinky. What if there's one of those blue dye packs inside? You know, the ones that explode in your face when you open the sack of money.
Alvarez says there's no dye packs, said Reuben.
What if some kind of tracking chip starts beaming out a signal to the cops when you open the bag?
Alvarez says no. Nothing but money inside. Jeffrey chuckled.
Dumb fucks need to watch more cop shows. Open the bag, bro!
He tried to puncture it with the kitchen knife and nearly broke the blade. The bag was impenetrable.
I need a power tool.
Jeffrey got an electric drill and a steel bit from the tool board. Reuben used it like a jigsaw to cut a fist-sized hole in the bottom of the bag. He reached inside eagerly, grabbing and pulling brick after brick through the hole. The bag hemorrhaged $50 and $100 bills until it was empty.
Holy shit!
said Jeffrey, staring at the pile of money on the concrete floor.
Pretty, huh? Said Reuben.
Four more just like it.
Who's going to do the counting?
Asked Pinky.
I'll do it, said Jeffrey.
You can't count that fucking high.
Then let Savannah count it,
said Jeffrey.
She'll get it right.
Savannah was Reuben's wife and Jeffrey's younger sister. The joke in the family was that Savannah got the looks, but Savannah got the brains, which strangely always made brother Jeffrey laugh. She was a Latina beauty with none of her brother's weight issues. Wow, gorgeous, sexy, and linda como su madre were typical of the ways people described her. Reuben was handsome, not in the classic sense, but more in the bad boy Mark Anthony mold. So it was plain to see why he'd fallen for the neighborhood version of J-Lo. Some said there was nothing he wouldn't do to keep her.
Savannah's not home, said Reuben. I made sure of that.
How much does she know?
Asked Pinky. Reuben looked right at his accomplice, making sure he understood.
Nada.
Savannah knows nothing.
But she has to find out sometime, said Jeffrey.
She finds out when I'm ready to tell her.
Got it?
Yeah, sure. Whatever you say.
I'll count the money, said Reuben.
It took hours to cut open the bags, count each bill, and divide each player's take into separate piles. Three times Jeffrey had gone out to use the bathroom. Each time he'd come back all wired up and sniffling, unable to stop pacing a circle around the money. Clearly, he'd been blowing coke. That was one drug Reuben had no use for. Some guys claimed it was an aphrodisiac, but as far as he could see, doing coke only made you want to do one thing. More coke. By midnight, there were seven stacks on the floor. Reuben announced the final tally. $1 million for Alvarez, the armored car insider. $1 million for Marco.
The rest is ours, said Reuben. Three-way split.
How much? How much?
Asked Jeffrey.
$2.5 million in change.
Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Wait, is that before or after taxes?
It was late, Reuben was exhausted, and he was in no mood for his brother-in-law's jokes.
Listen up, he said. I'll make sure Alvarez gets his money. Pinky, did you and Marco work out a time and place to get his share to him?
Pinky had brought Marco into the heist. They'd met in prison.
I'll take care of it.
Please tell me you have a plan in place, said Reuben.
I said I'll take care of it.
Damn it, Pinky. I don't want phone calls flying back and forth about splitting up the money. I gave Alvarez clear instructions. Third Tuesday, 8 a.m., corner of U.S. 1 and Bird. Boom. Octavio knows to be there, no phone calls needed. You and Marco were supposed to do the same.
Alvarez is different. The FBI will be watching the guards like a hawk. Nobody knows to keep an eye on Marco.
We can't get sloppy anywhere.
Here's the plan, said Jeffrey. I'll take my money now. I am going to party tonight.
No, you're not, said Reuben. We are going to lay low.
Low, uh-huh. Real low,
Jeffrey said in the deep rhythmic voice of a rapper. He arched his back and mimicked a limbo dance, his shirt rising up to expose his big belly above the belt line.
How low can you go, bro?
Reuben smacked him across the head, knocking Jeffrey onto his ass.
I'm serious. Stop goofing off.
Jeffrey picked himself up.
It's my money, bro.
We're in this together. If one of us gets caught, we all get caught.
They catch me, I don't give up nobody,
said Jeffrey.
Just listen to me, said Reuben. This is how it's going to be. We don't go out drinking and partying. We don't flash money.
We all get up and do what we do on a regular Monday morning.
Cool. I sleep till noon, said Jeffrey.
The perfect cover for you would be to go out and start looking for work, said Reuben.
Fuck that, said Jeffrey. I don't ever have to go back to work now.
It's all about perception, said Reuben. You ever see the movie Goodfellas, Jeffrey?
No. What's that, gay porn?
It's about the guys who pulled off the biggest heist ever from JFK Airport. It went perfect.
Just like us.
Yeah, except we don't want to end up like them. They were snorting coke before they even counted up the money. It was fucking mafia wars before it was all over. Like a dozen guys ended up dead.
Yeah, so? That was them.
It could be us. This is no bullshit, bro. We gotta lay low.
What do we do with the money while we're laying low?
Asked Jeffrey. We stash it, said Reuben. 90 days minimum. We act like this never happened.
No, said Pinky. We gotta launder it. I saw this in a Ben Affleck movie. You buy shit, you go to the casino, you...
Forget it, said Reuben. Laundering the money is what the cops expect us to do. If we do what they expect, we get caught.
So when you say stash it, you mean what?
Asked Pinky. Simple. First, we put the money in vacuum-sealed bags.
Vacuum cleaner bags?
Asked Jeffrey. No, moron. It's a machine. I bought it already. It seals things in plastic so no air and no water can get inside. You can use it on anything. Food, clothes.
Money?
You got it. So we seal the bricks into packets that hold anywhere from 10 to 25 grand, and we stuff the packs inside PVC pipe. I bought the pipe already, too.
Okay, then what?
Reuben walked toward the rack of tools on the other side of the garage and grabbed a shovel.
We bury it.
You want to stick $7.5 million in the ground?
Asked Pinky.
Yep.
Where?
Reuben smiled a little.
Where no one will find it.
Jeffrey grimaced, clearly not in love with the idea. Pinky was more vocal.
This is stupid. Marco and Octavio get their money, but we gotta bury ours?
I'm not related to those guys, said Reuben. We're family. We need to act as one unit, and this unit is flying under the radar.
Fine, said Pinky.
Seal up the money and each of us buries his own share. I don't trust you guys to bury it, said Reuben.
I don't trust you to keep my money, said Pinky.
This is not negotiable, said Reuben. I'm keeping control.
Not of my money, you're not.
Mine neither, said Jeffrey. Stay out of this, Jeffrey, said Reuben. Pinky stepped closer.
Give me my money, bro, before this gets ugly.
Jeffrey backed away from them nervously.
Guys, come on. Let's not fight.
Pinky pulled his cell from his pocket, his gaze fixed on Reuben.
No one's going to fight. Either I walk out of here with my money, or I call my sweet little niece and tell her what her husband's been up to today.
I'm going to tell her myself, said Reuben.
Bullshit, said Pinky. You want to sit on the money until you figure out some explanation that doesn't involve you stealing it.
Their eyes locked, and the glares intensified. Neither man blinked, and Reuben could feel the power shift in the air. The honeymoon had barely started. Already, it was over. Chapter 4. It was 5 a.m. when Reuben returned home.
He tried not to wake Savannah as he climbed into bed, but his head hit the pillow so hard that she stirred. She snuggled up next to him.
How did it go? She asked.
He told her only that Jeffrey was doing coke again, which was true, and that the intervention would probably keep him out late, which was a lie. His muscles still ached from burying the money, his share, along with Octavio's and some of Jeffrey's. Pinky had gotten his way.
I'm really worried about Jeffrey, he told her. I love you so much for that. I don't know what my poor mother would do without you. Did Jeffrey give you a hard time?
Oh, yeah. He gave me a hard time, all right.
Pinky's insistence that each man hide his own money had emboldened Jeffrey, and it had been World War III to get Jeffrey to leave behind a withhold of $500,000 for Reuben to bury. You can take the rest and stash it yourself, Reuben had told him. But if I see you flashing money, you forfeit half a mil. It had seemed like a workable solution at the time, but Reuben was having second thoughts.
I'm afraid he's going to take us all down, said Reuben. That won't happen, she said.
Don't be so sure, he said. They were speaking about two entirely different things, but Reuben wasn't ready to tell her about the money. Not yet.
Jeffrey can't hurt us, she said.
Sure he can. He's a cokehead. She ran her finger lightly across his chest.
That's him, not us. You are strong. You are smart. You have a beautiful, sexy wife.
She kissed the side of his mouth, but he didn't react.
One slip and all that's gone, he said.
He propped himself up on his elbow, looking at her in the darkness. There was just enough moonlight streaming through the blinds for him to see.
The slightest slip, that's all it takes. Poof. You can lose everything. Reuben, you're kind of scaring me.
He hesitated, wondering if it was the right time. He eased into it.
Tonight wasn't about an intervention.
What?
It was about money.
You mean our money? He didn't answer. She looked at him with concern.
Reuben, are we in money trouble again?
The fear in her voice was eerily reminiscent of the bad old days of lying awake at night and wondering how much longer they'd be able to make their mortgage payments, wondering if the bank would work with them, if they could avoid foreclosure, if tomorrow would be the day that the MDPD officers would show up with a court-issued writ to haul them and their possessions out into the front yard. It was a journey they'd taken together, and he'd been honest with her every grim step of the way. This was different. Savannah wasn't part of this.
Jeffrey messed up royally this time, he said.
Does he need to borrow money? Don't give him money to buy drugs.
No, it's not that.
Reuben reached for his smartphone on the nightstand, brought up the front page of the Miami Herald, and handed it to her. She read it to herself, her confused face aglow from the LCD screen.
Are you saying Jeffrey is involved in this?
Yes, said Reuben. Jeffrey and your uncle.
Oh, no. I swear. I wish my scumbag uncle had never gotten out of prison. There is not a member of my family that he hasn't shamed or hurt. This has always been my biggest fear, that Jeffrey would get mixed up with him.
He's mixed up big time.
She glanced at the display, her eyes widening.
It says here the heist could be in the millions of dollars. They stole all that?
With some other guys.
Who?
One of Pinky's friends, he said, a half-truth. They made off with $9.6 million.
Where does it say that? She asked, checking the article again.
It doesn't say it.
Then how do you know?
If he was going to tell her, this was his opportunity. But it was hard to come clean when part of him still couldn't believe that he'd even attempted such a thing, let alone gotten away with it. Even after he'd held the money in his own hands, Reuben Betancourt, as mastermind of Miami's biggest heist in history, didn't feel at all like the truth.
That's where I was all night, he said. I helped them hide their share of the money.
She sat up, practically jackknifing in the bed. Reuben! No! Her reaction made him jump, and it pushed him even farther toward the new truth.
What was I supposed to do, Savannah?
The two of them showed up at our house with big bags of money. The cops were looking for them, and neither one of them had any idea what to do. They should turn it back in. You can't just give back the money and make this go away. This is no different than robbing a bank and your uncle had a gun. Using a firearm to steal this much money could land both of them in prison for the rest of their lives.
Oh, my poor mother.
We don't have to tell your mother. We don't have to tell anyone. She fell back into the pillow.
What are we going to do?
It's under control for now. They promised not to spend the money and to keep it hidden until we figure out what to do.
You can't trust them to keep that promise.
They were on the same page, but he needed to allay her concerns.
It's fine. The money is buried in sealed bags.
All of it?
One more lie wouldn't hurt. Yes, all of it.
But if you help them hide the money, that makes us part of it.
He took her hand. No. It makes me part of it, not you. Even in the darkness, he could see that he'd touched her heart. She sat right back up and held him tight.
Oh, honey, my family is so screwed up, and you spend so much of your life picking up the pieces. But this is way more than I can ask.
No, we're all family. I'll make this right. Just don't tell Jeffrey or your uncle that you know anything. They trust me on this. If they find out I told you, they will dig up that money and all hell will break loose.
I won't say a word. But please don't let this drag on. We have to decide something quick.
She embraced him tightly. Reuben lay back into the pillow. Savannah nuzzled up against him and laid her head on his chest.
Do you really think you can fix this?
Yes. We'll be fine. Just remember, keep this between us. I'll handle it.
Okay. I promise.
She pulled away. One more thing to add to the list on an unbelievable day. She'd bought it. Reuben was dead tired, but he couldn't close his eyes. As he lay staring at the ceiling, the truth started to replay in his mind. He and Pinky rushing into the warehouse, the money grab, the getaway. He shook off those unforgettable images and glanced over at his wife. The curve of Savannah's body beneath the bedsheet. She was right beside him as close as ever. As close as the bag of money. The $2 million that he'd dropped and left lying on the warehouse floor. Don't think about that. He reached over and rested his hand gently on her hip.
Are you okay now? He asked.
I'm much better.
Reuben took a deep breath and let it out. The air conditioning cycled off. The bedroom fell quiet.
Me too,
he said into the darkness.
Chapter 5. On Monday morning, Andy and Agent Littleford paid a visit to Braxton Security. A fleet of armored trucks was stationed less than 2 miles from the Miami Fed, the vaults of which were officially short $9.6 million. Andy wondered if the crooks might be right across the street at Doral Country Club, smoking cigars and thumbing their noses at law enforcement from the manicured greens of the Blue Monster, one of the most famous golf courses in the world.
"You golf, Andy?" asked Littleford.
Andy glanced out the passenger side window as they cruised past the groomed fairways. "Nope."
"If you ever want to drop $400 for 5 hours of aggravation and 18 reasons to swear your head off, this is the place."
"I'll keep that in mind." Littleford looked ready for a round of golf, his khaki pants and short-sleeved Hawaiian shirt, not just for weekends. Sunday afternoon's interviews at the airport warehouse had gone as expected. No one had broken down, confessed, and pleaded for mercy. Two of the guards were targeted for a follow-up, Alvarez in particular. Andy and her supervisory agent met with him in a conference room at the office suite. The assistant general counsel for Braxton was also in the room, along with a junior member of the in-house legal staff. Andy did the interviews. Each took about an hour. They called Alvarez back for a short but to-the-point follow-up. The Braxton lawyers gave the FBI the green light to turn up the heat. Andy ran with it.
"Mr. Alvarez, let me spell this out for you. We think you're holding back."
"Me? Nah. Nothing to hold back."
Andy allowed the blanket of silence to settle over them. It was amazing what a nervous target might say when left to stew, no question pending. Alvarez had lived in Miami for almost 15 years, having come to Florida just 6 months after graduation from high school in Havana. It was impossible to land a job at Braxton with a criminal record, and his was clean, at least since coming to this country. Andy wondered about the inaccessible juvenile record he may have left behind in a country that shared nothing with the United States. She leaned closer, resting her crossed forearms on the table.
"One of the warehouse workers says he saw you using a cell phone before the heist."
It was a bluff, but the FBI was convinced that someone from inside the warehouse had signaled the robbers. The guy remained cool.
"That's a lie," said Alvarez. "I never use my cell on duty."
Andy didn't miss a beat. "Let me be clear, Mr. Alvarez. We are going to turn that warehouse upside down and inside out. Maybe you cloned somebody's cell so it couldn't be traced to you. Maybe you used your sister's cell. Maybe it's a disposable. Whatever phone you used, you had to ditch it somewhere in that warehouse. We are going to find it. I'm giving you a chance to tell me now, before all bets are off."
"Maybe you didn't hear me the first time," he said, not the slightest quake in his voice. "I never use a cell on the job."
"Suit yourself," said Andy. "But remember what I tell you today. Count one. Octavio Alvarez did conspire to obstruct commerce by robbery by taking approximately $9.6 million in the United States currency by actual and threatened force and violence. Count two. Octavio Alvarez and his co-conspirators did knowingly commit such a crime of violence through the use of a firearm. I'm guessing 15 years in federal prison on count one, another 10 to 15 on count two. Those are just the obvious charges. I'm sure the U.S. attorney will tack on two or three more, including an order of restitution and the full amount of the heist that will follow you around for the rest of your life. My guess is that you'll be a 60-year-old man wishing he could afford his prescription for Viagra by the time you get out of prison and make love to a woman again. Have a nice day, Mr. Alvarez."
Alvarez addressed the company lawyers.
"Is that all?"
Yes, Mr. Alvarez, you're excused. He rose. The junior lawyer escorted him to the door, and Alvarez left the room.
You think he's our man? Asked the general counsel.
Hard to say, said Littleford. If he is, we know he didn't use a cell phone registered under his own name.
How do you know that? Andy explained. We don't need a warrant to get the transactional details from a person's cell. That includes time and date of phone calls, the GPS coordinates of the caller's location, and the numbers dialed. Alvarez's cell is clean all yesterday afternoon. No calls. Same with all the Braxton guards.
As they should be, said the lawyer. Guards can't talk in their cell while on duty. Which is why we think our insider used a phone that's not registered in his name and ditched it somewhere in that warehouse, said Littleford.
Or it could be in 1,000 tiny pieces and flushed down the toilet, said Andy.
So what's next? The lawyer asked. Will you wiretap his phone, follow him?
We'll let you know, said Littleford.
There's one other thing we should discuss, said Andy. The reward.
We're on that, the lawyer said. Braxton will offer $250,000 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of those responsible and the return of the money.
I got a problem with that, said Littleford.
That's a big reward. What's the problem?
Don't make the reward conditional on return of the money.
The lawyer smiled a little, but it wasn't a friendly smile.
No offense, but it's the FBI's job to catch the crooks. Braxton's primary interest here is the return of the money.
You're asking someone to risk his life by coming forward and fingering the guys who did this. Arrest and conviction is enough. Don't be a prick who says, sorry, we only recovered 9 million of the 9.6 million, so no reward. That makes you no better than those car ads that offer a top-of-the-line luxury sedan for $99 a month, but the fine print requires you put $29,000 down on signing.
I disagree. Thankfully, no one was injured here. All we're talking about is money, so the reward is conditioned on its return.
You're not seeing the big picture, said Littleford.
I assure you, a lot of careful thought and consideration goes into the formulation of our rewards.
Littleford nodded as if to acknowledge the party line.
Let me give you and your company a little different perspective. Everyone remembers the big Lufthansa heist at JFK in December 1978 because Martin Scorsese made a movie out of it.
Good fellas, I know. It's practically required viewing in our line of work.
See, that's the problem. People forget all the other heists, all the other robberies in New York. But I remember because my old man was with NYPD when I was a kid. A big hit puts ideas in crooks' heads. A few months after JFK, New York had 18 bank robberies, 18 in 3 days. 5 on Monday, 10 on Tuesday, and 3 more on Wednesday. 2 of them were big hits over $1 million, like JFK. Mayor Koch went nuts, warning these guys in the newspapers and on TV to remember what happened to Dillinger.
That's a nice history lesson, but we have an excellent safety record.
History repeats itself. You have a lot of armored trucks out on the streets of Miami every day. Hundreds of gangbangers and small-time crooks with big ideas saw the news reports of this multi-million dollar job at the airport. A quick tip is the fastest way to solve this case. It's your best shot at recovering your money. And catching these crooks is the best way to make sure we don't see 18 armored truck heists in the next week.